I want to invite you to open up your Bibles to Ecclesiastes 3. We've been going through this glorious book. I'm going to start reading at verse 1 and go down to verse 15. This is the word of our God. For everything there is a season, and a time for every matter under heaven, a time to be born, and a time to die, a time to plant, and a time to pluck up what is planted, a time to kill, and a time to heal, a time to break down, and a time to build up, a time to weep, and a time to laugh, a time to mourn, and a time to dance, a time to cast away stones, and a time to gather stones together, a time to embrace, and a time to refrain from embracing, a time to seek, and a time to lose, a time to keep, and a time to cast away. A time to tear, and a time to sow. A time to keep silence, and a time to speak. A time to love, and a time to hate. A time for war, and a time for peace. What gain has the worker from all his toil? I have seen the business that God has given to the children of Adam to be busy with. He has made everything beautiful in its time. He has put either the eternity or the world into man's heart, yet so that he cannot find out what God has done from the beginning to the end. I perceive that there is nothing better for them than to be joyful and to do good as long as they live. Also that everyone should eat and drink and take pleasure in all his toil. This is God's gift to Adam or to man. I perceive that whatever God does endures forever. Nothing can be added to it. Nothing can be taken from it. God has done it so that people fear before him. That which is already has been. That which is to be already has been. And God seeks what has been driven away. Have you ever found yourself in the middle of a traffic jam? Most days, my commute to work is very uneventful. Three cars at the corner here is a long wait. But on Friday morning, I was on my way to Toronto and had gotten up bright and early so as to miss traffic and to arrive in downtown Toronto with time to spare, when, as I was coming through Kitchener on Highway 8, traffic ground to an absolute standstill. It wasn't even 7 o'clock, and I was wondering, what is going on? This never happens. Traffic is always moving here. Now, I recognized that there was construction and that there could be some potential delays, but there is nothing more aggravating than being stuck in traffic, and I wasn't even to Toronto yet. I was waiting for it, but not in Kitchener. The movement was so slow, and as far as my eye could see, as I would try and peek around the vehicles in front of me to see how far was this, all I could see were cars and more cars. I wanted to be able to move along, and I knew that there was an exit coming up, and if we could just move over and slide off onto the exit, we could zip through the streets of Kitchener and get to the 401 more quickly. But no! No! The exit that I thought was right there is closed because of construction. And so as we sat there, it didn't matter how much wiggling around or looking ahead, it didn't matter how much we did that would help us, I was stuck, and you know what I kept doing? We'd move 3 feet, I'd look at the clock. We'd look forward, drive 3 feet, I'd look at the clock. And we did this for 25 minutes. Time. It's something that, well, as we get older, we feel it move faster. I would love for a scientist to do a study and understand why time seems to move more rapidly the older we get. Yet it's something that, as much as time seems to pass by us, we try to find ways to control it. We have all these tools and resources. We have apps that are designed to be time savers. We have websites that give us life hacks so that you can do more complicated tasks in simpler steps to save yourself time. We even have time management seminars. We have things that we have books that are written called The 1 Minute Manager, so as to help you to manage time. But the problem with time is that it's unrelenting. The harder that I try to control time, the more it seems to just blow through my fingers or slip like it's sand. No matter how many day planners I have, no matter how many New Year's resolutions I make, no matter how much I try to learn about how to be more productive, time is slipping away. We look at this unending to-do list and we wonder, how are we ever going to get things done? And then as we age, we look back over our lives and we wonder, where did the years go? The plans, the hopes, the dreams, the aspirations, the very things that we wanted to accomplish that we thought, I've got so much time. We suddenly find ourselves at a place later in life where we go, boy, I did not have as much time as I thought. I did not get to do these things. And so we now create bucket lists as though there are these things that we have to put into our bucket that we have to accomplish before we kick the bucket. And if we can do those things, that somehow we will have felt like we have managed our time well. But we can grow in despair and see that the goals and hopes and dreams of our lives have been unrealized as time keeps ticking away. The wise sage of Ecclesiastes gives us a reflection on life. Specifically, poetically, he looks at life and this issue of time. He gives us a poem that is so well crafted and well designed. 14 pairs that he gives us. These polar opposites. These opposites that are intended to show us this contrast. A time to be born, a time to die. You want to sing the birds now with me? Most people know this passage because of the birds. To everything, turn, turn, turn. And we know Ecclesiastes 3. It's part of our cultural mindset. We know this. We sing this. We hear it. But we haven't come to grips with it. Because time keeps ticking away. Look at the polar opposites that the wise sage shows us in verses 2 through 8. There's a season, he says, for everything in verse 1, a time for every matter under heaven. A time to be born and a time to die, a time to plant, a time to pluck up what's planted, a time to kill, a time to heal, a time to break down, a time to build up, a time to weep, a time to laugh, a time to mourn, a time to dance, a time to cast away stones, a time to gather stones together, a time to embrace, a time to refrain from embracing, a time to seek, a time to lose, a time to keep, a time to cast away, a time to tear, and a time to sow, a time to keep silence, and a time to speak, a time to love, and a time to hate, a time for war, and a time for peace. What do we make of this poem? It's this poem, it begins with that there's a time of being born and of dying, and it ends with there's a time for war and peace. There's wounds, and there's healing, there's love, and there's hate. There are all these things, and we could consider them, but we don't have enough time. Because we're sensitive to the fact that we're on this tight schedule, and we have to keep our time. But I want us to notice a couple things. Notice in verses 2 through 8, there are many good things. Being born, planting, harvesting, building up, laughing, dancing, gathering, loving, peacemaking. There is so much here that is delightful because God made a world, as he said in Genesis 1, it is good. The second day, it is good. The third day, it is good. All the way till he finishes and he makes man in his own image and he says it's very good. But this poem tells us that there is also this heartbreak and this joylessness that comes into the world. There's a time for death, killing, destruction, loss, wounds, tears, hatred, war. While we live in a world made by God, which is good, we also feel that this world is not the way that it ought to be. It's also a busy world. It's a time for planting. It's a time for harvesting. It's a time for casting stones and gathering them and embracing. There's a busyness about life that we see here. There's just this relentless busyness of life. And life has a lot of busyness. And at times we can wonder, why do we do the very things that we do? Well, I was thinking of our home, where we've been going through 40 math questions in the evenings, and hearing a student say, why does my teacher give me 40 questions that are the exact same but just with different numbers? What's the point of all this? Why do we keep doing this? A worker stands on a factory line and does the same motion every time. A grocery clerk scans the items across the till and hits the total and swipes a card every time. There's a sense of repetition in life that just seems relentless. It feels like busy work. It gets exhausting and tiring. We have paperwork that we have to fill out over and over and over, and we wonder, does anybody really read all of these things on this paperwork that I'm filling out? The problem that we run into is something that I think if we were to look at the end of this poem at verse 8, we feel. This poem ends with the word shalom. A time for war and a time for shalom. In English, we like to translate this word as peace. This Hebrew word is a word that means that all will be reordered, reconfigured, and that there will be not only an absence of conflict, but that there will be perfect harmony in all things. And yet, scholars look at this poem and they go, what's the order of this poem? Can we discern any patterns as we read it? There just seem to be these opposites, and it seems so random. And rather than giving us a sense of order and of placement and of correctness and of reordering of all of life, this poem leaves us with this sense of tension. A time to be born and a time to die. A time to gather stones and a time to get rid of them. A time to embrace and a time to refrain from embracing. And all of these things feel like polar opposites. And if life feels like there's a randomness about it, it's because this poem reflects the same type of characteristic of the randomness of our lives. And it leads us to ask a question, which the wise sage does in verse 9. If life has all of these random things, then what is the point? What advantage or what profit, he asks in verse 9, what advantage or what profit is there from all the toil that we have? This is a question that the wise sage asked in chapter 1. He asked this very question. I think it was in chapter 1. Oh, I can't remember the verse now. Chapter 2, he asked this question. Again, he asked this question now in chapter 3. This is a question he repeatedly asks. What profit is there? Is there any benefit? Is there any advantage? Do I earn anything from all of this toil that I have? Thankfully, we're not left with a poem that is just random and seemingly disorganized with these polar opposites. But we are given the key to understanding to this poem by the wise sage. He makes several comments that helps us to see what he is doing. What advantage is there if life is fleeting? What advantage is there if time is tick, tick, ticking away? How can I enjoy these moments if I can't control the relentless ticking of the clock? Notice verses 10, 12, and 14. In fact, if you have a pen in your Bible, you should underline it, because this is the interpretive grid for this poem. He says in verse 10, I have seen. The first words, I have seen. And we're going to discover what he's seen. Verse 12, my Bible says, I perceived. I think literally it would be better to translate it as, I know. What does he know? And the same phrase is repeated again in verse 14. I perceived, or I know. So something has been revealed to this wise sage about the randomness of life and how it ought to be put together. So let's put these things together. What is it that this wise sage has seen? What is it that he has known not once but twice? What two things does he see? If I can't control the relentlessness of life, and if I can't stop the ticking of the clock, how do I enjoy it? First, verse 10. I have seen the business that God has given to the children of man to be busy with. He has made everything beautiful
in its time. Also, he has put eternity into man's heart, yet so that he cannot find out what God has done from the beginning to the end. What is the first thing that we need to know? What is the thing that we need to see in order to enjoy time, which keeps tick, tick, ticking away? I have seen that God has a plan, so I trust him. That's the first thing that we see. The first part of faith is seen right in these verses. God has put a desire in our hearts, we are told, to understand, well, and there are debates into how to translate in verse 11. Is it that he has put eternity into our hearts, or he's put the world into our hearts? The Hebrew word could mean several things. Regardless of whether it means he's put the world in our hearts or eternity in our hearts, the point, I think, is still the same. We have this relentless desire to know that there is an overarching purpose and meaning to life. God has put the world or eternity in our hearts, and we want to understand. We want to see that life fits together, that this world ticks, that there is meaning beyond my life. We want to know that things are not purposeless. But a lot of life does look purposeless, doesn't it? Let's be honest for a moment. When I lost my best friend in a car accident when he was only 18 years old, as I carried his casket to the grave, I wondered, what's the point of this? Why was his life cut so short? It made no sense. A random car accident that should never have occurred? What's the point? What's the point when there's a loved one that you have that has a spouse who walks out the door, leaving the other spouse and the children? And you wonder, what was that about? Is there any point? Is there any meaning in this? When the word cancer comes up and we hear this and we're devastated, we wonder, what is the meaning of this all? Let's be honest and say that life does look, in many senses, like it's pointless. We feel it. We would be liars to say that we don't struggle with that question. A hopeless future dashed, promising hopes and dreams gone. Life has this sense of randomness to it, and we can't control it. We can barely control our daytimers and our schedules, let alone what happens to us. So what are we to do? Well, the writer here, the wise sage, he says, I have seen the business that God has given to the children of man to be busy with. He has made everything, boy, how do we say this? Beautiful in its time. Purposeful could be another way that we could put that phrase. God has given us a work to do. He's given us good tasks to do. From Adam's toil in the garden to tend it and keep it, to have dominion and expand and multiply. That was the purpose that Adam was to have, and yet we feel that we do not have dominion. We do not have this sense of an ability to control. We don't have a grasp on the basic functions of life. We have people who come into our workplaces who mess things up and make it difficult. They send emails at the most inconvenient times. They are difficult in meetings. We cannot control the very work that we have to do on a day-to-day basis, and we get frustrated because we can't control our work. But God has given us a work to do, and while we don't feel this sense of dominion, there is this very simple truth, and it's this. The more that you try to control time, the less you're able to enjoy it. You try and control your life. You be a helicopter parent and try and spot your kid and protect them from every fall and keep them from every tragedy. You will not enjoy life, and neither will your child. You try to control everything that happens in your day and your time, and you will find that there is just this endless sense that you don't have control. And we have to learn that God is sovereign, that God rules over all things. This is why verse 1 becomes so important, that there is a season for everything, that there is intentionality in the plan and purposes and mind of God. It's under His control. Everything, whether life or death, war or peace, no matter what, God is in control. Nothing happens outside of His sovereign will. There is not a single bird that does not fall that He does not notice. There is not one single snowflake that comes from heaven that has not been spoken into existence by His own very mouth. There is nothing that happens outside of God who rules over all. Now, humans make foolish decisions. Humans make very foolish decisions. But it's not because God is the problem. It is because we try to be in control. From the very moment that Adam was tempted in the garden, "Eat this fruit, and you will be like God," we have heard that whisper, and we too have wanted to be in control. We have wanted to take the fruit and eat it so that we can be godlike. That we're not content when we feel out of control. We have this sense that eternity is in our hearts. That there's a big picture. That there's order. But let's be honest. How does it fit together? Under the sun, life looks very messy. I remember walking into this woman's home. I was visiting her, and she had this mess of yarn on the floor. It looked something like this. I could not figure out for the life of me what she was doing. There was this tangled mess all over the place. And when she saw me looking and staring at this mess of yarn, she said, "Oh, you want to see what I'm doing?" Well, I was kind of embarrassed because I thought, how am I going to rescue this situation? How do I compliment this absolute travesty? And then she flipped it over. And I saw that the mess was part of a tapestry that she had been weaving. And at the other side, it looked gloriously beautiful. Now, when I saw that big picture, I was amazed. I thought, boy, that's sure a big mess. But the difficulty that we have with God's plan is that it's like this tapestry. Under the sun, we look from a perspective up to heaven, and all we see are the tangled threads. And we can't make sense of what God is doing when we are here under the sun. If we could only step back, and if we could only get a big enough picture as to what God is doing, suddenly we might be able to see this beautiful woven tapestry that God is piecing together all things, that all things are being done according to the counsel of His will. But the problem is, I can never step back far enough to see what God is doing in the big picture. I can't. I have to read this word and believe that it's true, that God has a plan from the beginning of the garden to the city at the very end, that God has this purposeful, intentional plan that He is working out to accomplish His purposes. It doesn't mean that God's plans are purposeless when I don't see it. It's just that I'm human, and I'm confused, and I'm limited. And the sooner that we embrace our humanity, our limit, our limited nature, the better off we are, because the harder we try to control time, the less we can enjoy it. You see, I think we often want to know, what is the big picture? God set eternity in my hearts. I can't avoid the fact that I want to know how things fit together. This is the way that God has wired us. We want to know that things fit together. That's a good thing. It gives us this inquisitive nature as creatures to be creative and to try and correct the things that have been done wrong. And we want to advance and we want to develop technologies. This is put into our hearts. It's a good thing from our Creator. That being said, if I knew the big picture, what would I do with it? Wouldn't I want to control everybody because I have a knowledge that they don't?
Doesn't it put me back in the same spot that I am right now of wanting to control absolutely everything? My biggest frustration in life is that my heart is inclined to want to be controlling, because ever since the garden, when that piece of fruit was taken, be like God, eat it. The lie has been given to you and me by the serpent. You can control your life. You can be the captain of your soul. You can be the one who determines your own destiny. But accepting that you are not God and that you are a creature means that time is out of your control. And repentance begins not by controlling time, but by trusting God, who is the maker and the master of time. So you want to enjoy fleeting moments? You trust God that the beginning and the end have a thorough weaving together, and that nothing is wasted in his big purposes. He's got a plan. But we're also instructed on how we can enjoy time. The wise sage says, I know life is a gift, so enjoy it. Look at verses 12 and 13. I perceived, or better, I think, I knew that there is nothing better for them, that being the sons of men, than to be joyful and to do good as long as they live. Also that everyone should eat and drink and take pleasure in all his toil. This is God's gift to man. The only way to live fully in the present is to know that God is in control of all things. If we believe that God is in control, then it gives us this sense of relaxing. We can trust. We can let go of having to manage and manipulate. We don't have to orchestrate. We don't have to be passive-aggressive. We don't have to try and coerce people to do what we want. God's in control. So I don't have to be. And that frees me up in the present to enjoy it. We can believe, like the psalmist says in Psalm 115, verse 3, that our God is in the heavens and he does whatever he pleases. We can enjoy life. We can enjoy the unbearable nature of the confusion and the difficulties when I don't have to control it. Karl Barth, I put this in the e-bulletin on the weekend. Karl Barth, the German theologian, I wouldn't share many of his perspectives, but when he reflected on Ecclesiastes 3 and his enormous church dogmatics, he talked about how humanity has a way of wanting to know the future without hearing and obeying God and his word. And this independence and autonomy causes us to miss our true nature and our true essence. He says, humanity is always either too soon or too late. He's either asleep when he should be awake and awake when he should be asleep. I hope you're awake right now. He's silent when he should speak, and he speaks when it is better to be silent. He laughs when he should weep, and he weeps when he should be comforted and laugh. He always makes an exception where the rule should be kept, and subjects himself to law when he should choose freedom. He always toils when he should pray, and prays when only work is of any avail. He devotes himself to historical and psychological investigation when decisions are demanded, and rushes into decisions when historical and psychological investigation is really required. He is always contentious where it is unnecessary and harmful, and he speaks of peace where he may confidently attack. Humanity has a way, you see, of trying to act in sovereignty, which keeps us from enjoying the present. This is why I think Martin Luther, when he reflected on these passages in Ecclesiastes 3, he said that we should understand that all of our attempts at human effort, human work, is just another attempt to be godlike. And that when we try to control the world, it is functioning as though we do not live by grace but by works. And when we function as though we can control the world by our own works, we say, God is not sovereign, he does not rule, and I am in charge. Therefore, we live by works and not by faith. And if we live by works, Luther would go on to say, it just goes to prove that our wills are bound by sin and deception and are not free. But rather, when we learn to subject ourselves to the grace of God, that is when the will is truly free. This is the irony, that when we try to control, it is living by works, which is why Paul the Apostle condemns living by works of the law in Galatians.
But he makes it so abundantly clear that works do not save, they do not rescue us. If we want to arrange our life and work and plans and accomplish goals, we will become unflexible and unflinching in wanting to be the kind of people who have all that we want. I remember when Melanie and I, early on in our marriage, we delivered meals to seniors. And it was so interesting as I reflected. I was in my 20s, and we would take these meals to seniors, and something interesting would happen. Sometimes we would take the children along. We thought it'd be joyful to bring children along so that these seniors could enjoy this moment, get a meal, have a smile, see a kid, when their day and their world just continues to shrink because they lack mobility, they lack family who has time for them. So we thought this would be a joyful thing. And on one occasion, we were 5 minutes late, 5 minutes late to deliver a meal to this woman. We said, "Mrs. Smith, your meal's here. It's about time. Where have you been?" We had messed up her entire day because her meal was 5 minutes late. And this is the sense of trying to control life, that you can't enjoy the meal because it's 5 minutes late. How dare you? You bring kids who are smiling and singing, and I can't enjoy my food because it's not as hot as it would have been at 12 o'clock. And here we are. We fail to enjoy life when we do not trust that God is sovereign because we have to control it ourselves. But when we know that life is a gift, it's been given by God, we can enjoy the very present moment because the future's taken care of. You see? The future's taken care of so I can enjoy the present. But when I can't trust God that the future is taken care of, I have to manipulate and control and configure the present so that I can avoid any problem of the future. There's such an irony there. The more that you try to control time, the less you can enjoy it. So knowing that God is in control and enjoying the moment are not enough. The final thing that I want us to see that the wise sage says in verse 14 is that I know God's work will endure, so I obey. Look at verses 14 and 15. So he says, I know, or I perceived, that whatever God does endures forever. Nothing can be added to it, nor anything taken from it. God has done it so that people fear before him. That which is already has been, that which is to be already has been. And God seeks what has been driven away. And the wise sage tells us that there's nothing that can be added or taken from God's to-do list. He is the one who gets everything done. He accomplishes his purposes. As Ephesians 1:10 says, he accomplishes the purpose of the counsel of his will to his praise and glorious grace. And no matter how hard we try, our to-do list seems to build. I think as a pastor, I'll share with you, this is often the relentlessness of how I feel work is. I finish this sermon, I put it away, and guess what? I wake up tomorrow morning knowing Sunday's coming again. There's always someone else to visit. There's always one more task to be done. It's the same in your work, isn't it? The list of tasks never stops. If you're in the hospital, there's always one more patient to be seen. There's never going to be a stoppage of patients who are always feeling better. There's always someone sick. There's always someone needing an x-ray. There's always someone needing the doctor. There's always someone needing a prescription. And yet, it's relentless. Now, this does not mean, then, that if God is in control of all things, that I create this sense of passivity and go, well, I have no control over my day, so throw my hands up, whatever. No, we ought to work hard. Going back to verse 12, that we ought to do good as long as we live, the sage says. But if we see that there is only one who has ever completed his to-do list, it frees us from the tyranny of the moment. Jesus came and he said in John 5, verse 19, the Son only does that which his Father instructs him to do. He only says what the Father has for him to do. And he does the work of the Father through the Gospel of John. And when he comes to the cross and he is nailed to that cross, he can say the words, it's one word in Greek, tetelestai. It is finished. He's the only one who ever finishes his to-do list. And that's a relief, isn't it? Isn't it a relief to know that you may never get your to-do list all checked off because on the bottom there's always more things to add and you can tear off the page and you can start fresh, but you never finish your to-do list. But there is someone who does finish his to-do list, and by going and doing the work of his Father, he finishes the very good work. And he tells us in John 6:29, I believe it is, that this is the work that the Father has for you, that you would believe in the Son. And that if you would believe him, if you would trust in him, if you would trust that his work is finished, then he gives you good works that you should walk in them. For we are Christ's workmanship, Paul says to the Ephesians 2:10. Created in Christ Jesus to do good works, which God has prepared beforehand that we should walk in them. He can look back, and we can see this in Psalm 90, where Moses says, "Teach me to number my days, that I might walk with wisdom," and ends that same psalm by recognizing while his days are fleeting, he can say, "Establish the work of my hands." Yes, establish the work of my hands. We can let go of our to-do list and believe that our work in the Lord is not in vain, because there is a day where the Son who finished his work was raised to life, is seated at the right hand of the Father, and is interceding for you so that you can do the work of the Father. So Paul can say at the end of 1 Corinthians 15, verse 58, "So our labor in the Lord is not in vain." You see, there's a freedom that comes in your work. You don't have to get your to-do list done. Because when you know that God's in control, you don't have to control everything and figure out how it fits. You trust God, you enjoy the moment, and you work so that you might fear him. Now, for many people, when they come to this word, the fear of God, they wonder, why would we ever fear God? God who is loving, who is gracious, why would we ever fear him? But we fail to understand that when the Bible speaks of fearing God, it's not talking about this trembling terror that we're afraid of wrathful punishment. If that's our concept of fear, the fear of God, we have utterly missed it. When the Old Testament, and even the New, speaks of fearing God, it has more of this sense of trusting God, of having this awe of his greatness and awesomeness, a respect for who God is in all of his holiness and splendor, and that I see who God is, and in light of that, I respond by obeying. In fact, this is how the book of Ecclesiastes ends, that there is nothing better, that we should fear God and obey his commands. This is what he says in Ecclesiastes 12:13. The end of the matter, all has been heard. Fear God and keep his commandments, for this is the whole duty of man. At critical moments in Ecclesiastes, we're going to run into this phrase, fearing God. And we have to rightly understand that if we are going to enjoy the moment, it's going to require skillful living. And skillful living comes by entrusting ourselves, submitting ourselves, believing in, knowing that God is in control. And I am not. I trust him. I believe in him. But if I'm going to try and control my life and figure out how everything fits together, it's like shepherding the wind. It's an act of arrogance. I can try and control my life, but it does not mean that it's going to mesh with God's greater purposes. If God is doing 10,000 things in my life, and he's doing 10,000 things in your life, you might be fortunate to know three of them. Three of them. But that doesn't mean that his purposes and plans are bad. It just means that you're a creature who lives and who has to submit and believe and obey and say, "God, I don't know." I was recently talking with a young man. He's been going through a terrible time in his life. And he asked the question. He said, "Andrew, it seems like sometimes obeying God just results in more difficulty. I see people who disobey God and they disregard him and their life seems to be so much easier and I wonder, why do I keep doing what I'm doing? Am I stupid? It's one of those questions that we need to wrestle with because in a culture of convenience, in a world where we want our lives to be in control, where we want to be happy, we saw last week there's a huge problem with pleasure. It's fleeting. It doesn't last. It was good for me to contemplate, why do the righteous suffer and the wicked prosper? Why are babies born and they die prematurely? Why do natural disasters come and destroy communities and cities? Why do people who love God and are sacrificing their lives for the good of others end up being beheaded? I don't know. I honestly don't know. Does it bother me? Absolutely. But it drives me to my knees and to say, God, I do not know what you're doing. Forgive me for when I judge you based on my minuscule perception of life, and I think I can tell you what you ought to do. How utterly arrogant of me. Why was God patient with the Amalekites in the Old Testament for 400 years when they should have been destroyed and wiped off the face of the earth? People who killed their children and sacrificed them to the gods. Why did God endure with them for 400 years? God is patient and he is slow to anger that he might grant you repentance unto faith. And sometimes our suffering, we do not see the big picture, but it is a suffering that may be for the good of someone else and not ultimately for us. And that God would bring many sons to glory through children who do not know what God is doing. So we entrust ourselves to him and we believe and we say, God, my life isn't your life. This is what Paul says to the Ephesian elders. I do not consider my life of my own value, Acts 20. But only that I might run the race and finish the course that you have set out for me. When we obey God, when we do his good works, we can trust that he will make all things beautiful in its time. But you have to believe it when you don't see it. In the movie Titanic, the main character, Jack, he's this rebellious sort of chap who sneaks on the Titanic. He wants to own the world. And at one point, he mounts the ship's bow, pumps his fist, he throws out his arms, and he yells, I'm king of the world! He looks like he's the captain of his own soul, the master of his own fate. But as the movie progresses, scenes later, Jack is holding on to the side of a life raft, looking at this beloved Rose that he met on the ship. And as the ship goes down and it sinks into the dark Atlantic waters, soon Jack also follows as he can no longer hang on in the icy cold waters of the Atlantic, sinking to his own watery grave. There is only one king of the world. And every tick of the clock reminds us that the Lord has his plans. And we will make our plans. And we will try and do the things that we believe God wants us to do. But it is the Lord's purpose that will prevail. So, Father, we do pray. If we are for but a moment, and you are forever, if you are the Lord of the ages, if you are God of all time, if we will just be here and then for a moment and be gone, then may we live our lives in such a way where we entrust ourselves to you, the just God who will do and act justly. We do pray, Lord, use our lives in such a way that they are disproportionate to our abilities. Make the labors of our hands be established because it is your work. May we not work for this city, but a lasting city. That we could say, like I prayed before, Ruler Supreme, who hearest humble prayer, hold our dominion in thy loving care, Help us to find, O God, in thee a lasting rich reward, as waiting for a better day. On thee we obey.